Hi there. My name is Randall Graham. I'm the winemaker of Bonnie Doon Vineyard in Santa Cruz, California, and you're listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 12. It's a new year, and we are about to crush it this 2016. With more amazing stories and tips from our peeps in the land of Ciderville. This is Real Wind Color, your Cider MC. Subscribers of this podcast know that we are taking a journey each week down along Orchard Lane and into the juicy, indeed tasty world of Ciderville, chatting with you and cider makers and enthusiasts. So what say you? Are you a commercial cider maker? A hobbyist? One of the growing number of brilliant people who have a thirst for cider? Or one of the many amazing people who just happen upon this podcast for the first time? Well, now, there is something for everyone. And let me be the first to say, welcome to Cider Chat. Oh yeah, I love that music. Just sets my feet a stomping and get me into the beat of Ciderville. So glad you are coming along on this journey. And this week we have a fantastic chat with Randall Graham, who is a winemaker but also makes cider. I mean, cider, okay, yes, cider is made like wine. But people who really identify themselves as cider makers, I found that their craft tastes a wee bit different than folks who identify as winemakers. And that's something that we'll be kind of exploring as we roll into Ciderville each week. But Randall Graham is from Bonnie Doon Vineyards. He founded Bonnie Doon's actually back in 1983, and that's a great chat. But I'm going to just hold that chat just for a bit. So if you've already poured your glass, that's cool. Go ahead, sip away. Before I get there, I just want to share with you my word for 2016, because I think we all think about resolutions and where we're going in the coming year. And certainly for cider, it's taking off. And that's why we are crushing it. I mean, crush the apples, press the apples, make the cider. Well, anyways, so my word is savor. And I just believe in this. I believe in savoring the cider, finding what that cider maker was really trying to bring out with that particular blend of apples they were doing, and finding the best in every cider. That's how I believe one can savor the cider. At least I am working on that. And also, I wish for you, as I wish for myself, that we savor every moment and that we notice time instead of letting it slip by like sand through our fingers. Now, I want to thank some people that have not let time slip by because they recently left a review and rating, actually 5-star rating on iTunes for this little podcast. And one kind of stood out to me, and it is from Scott. And Scott wrote, let me pull this up a little bit closer. The cider industry is going to take off like craft beers did. There is some great information in here. I want to start making cider at one point. Or I wanted to start making cider at one point. Then I realized I couldn't because apple trees don't grow in Texas. Great information from those people that know how to do it. Well, Scott, actually, people are making cider in Texas, and you could too. I did a quick little Google search. Not that I've had any ciders from Texas, but I saw the Texas Keeper Cider. They're in Twin Creeks Road, down by Austin, I believe, on Austin East Ciders and Bishop Cider Company. And I'm sure there's even more places. So if you're a cider maker in Texas, let me know, and we'll kind of try to let Scott know that too. And there was also some other really nice reviews and ratings, and I liked the one from Harold. I love this podcast. Aw, thanks, Harold. The art and craft of cider and meeting some super talented guests. Rhea is an amazing host with a soothing voice and manner. Share virtual beverage with Rhea through this podcast. Aw, and a 5-star rating too. See, folks like that keep this podcast thriving, and you can too. And not only can you leave a review and rating, but by doing that between now and January 16th, you will be entered into the Cider Swag Contest to win some swag from Angry Orchard, who lovingly donated some orchard glass, and they were designed specifically for cider, and some keychains and cool stuff. So if that is something that you could take a moment to do, it would mean so much to me and help this podcast move forward, because pretty soon I'm going to be picking the best reviews and ratings. And if you want to get the details, just go to thesiderchat.com website and look up the page titled Cider Swag Contest. It's right there up on the top. It's very easy. It doesn't take a lot of time, and it's a great way to support this podcast. Alrighty. I'd like to give you some background information on Randall Graham, who we'll be having a cider chat with very soon. He's been rocking the world of winemaking for over 30 years. His label, Bonnie Doon Vineyard, started out in 1983, and I know he was part of the wine subculture. I don't know if that's what you might want to call it, but he's been involved in wine even before then. He opened a tasting room in the hills north of Santa Cruz, California, in the village of Bonnie Doon, which is spectacular. It's surrounded by beautiful redwoods, and there's still a tasting room right down on the Pacific Highway north of Santa Cruz on Route 1 in the town of Davenport, which is well worth a stop in. He authored a book in 2012 called Been Doon So Long, which I just love. He's kind of Dr. Seussical in a way. And he's essentially a winemaker extraordinaire. And he has a title and responsibility of being president for life of Bonnie Doon Vineyard. I love that. His accomplishments in the world of wine are as unique as Randall Graham himself. He's known as the Rhone Ranger. And he's also quite well known for pioneering the use of screw caps on wine bottles. For those of you who were around at that time, and certainly I remember, when screw caps came out, it was like, what? Who's doing this? How did this happen? And I know he had to kind of like hold that fort. That's part of his legacy. And certainly we see screw caps used all over the place on premium wines. And even though we know that corks are sexy, well, there's a sustainability issue there. And, you know, why not use screw caps on products? Really, is it going to impact it that much? I don't know. Maybe that's the topic. I should have talked to him about that, but we didn't go there. What we did do, you know, because he is a winemaker, you would think, well, Rhea, were you talking about his wines? And no, indeed, this is Cider Chat. And we talked about cider. And they have some, or he has some amazing ciders that I just found to be very, very unique. One is a query. And a query is made with pear, apple, and quince. And if you've ever held a quince in your hand, it's kind of a large, almost not quite like the size of a softball, a little bit smaller, kind of leathery on the outside. But the aroma of a quince is just something I just adore. It's just super fragrant, fruity, and delightful. So he has a query and then also a sparkling perry. So kind of unique products. And we haven't talked to anyone doing this quite yet. And I was able to actually have both the query and the perry while I was in California and during my stay in the Santa Cruz area. That's a little bit of a tidbit. You're also going to hear about a project that he's been working on called Popolachon. And you could get quite a bit more information on the show notes. And I'll remind you about that at the end and redirect you back to that. But meanwhile, I think it's time that we all grab a glass and join this chat with Randall Graham of Bonnie Doon Vineyard in Santa Cruz, California.
Can I help you find something?
Yeah, hi. I'm here to speak to Randall and I'm Austin. Okay. You're expecting me?
I haven't seen Randall. He left for a little bit, but okay. Austin should be in here.
Awesome.
Hey, Rhea.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
coming to my office.
All right, go and get them.
Oh, thank you, Austin.
It was a pleasure to meet you.
So nice to meet you. Thanks for setting this up.
Oh, I'm happy to do so.
I'm really curious about what you're doing with your cider. I know you have the Perry's, and you're working with quince. I really am
quince
fascinated.
Quince is an amazing fruit. Misunderstood, unknown largely. It's not the obvious choice for cider because there's no juice in quince. However, there is beautiful fragrance in quince.
Yeah.
So as and also nice astringency. So as a component in cider, it actually brings some of the elements that are missing from some of our pomme fruits, from our apples and pears. We don't have typically enough tannin in our apples and pears. So quince does that.
Yeah, that's what's so unique about it. So when you're working with the quince, you're not doing it as a normal pressing, or are you? Or you're adding?
Not at all, because there's very little juice. So what we do, the pears and apples we mill and press, typically.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the quince we just mill, put them in muslin bags, tie them up, and use them kind of essentially as like tisane, like
mm-hmm.
a tea bag.
Mm-hmm,
just
mm-hmm.
let it steep mm-hmm. in the juice, so it ferments with the pulp, with the
right.
mash, if you will.
Right. Huh.
Until it's quincy enough.
Yeah.
And then we pull the little quince goes a long way. So
yeah.
It's an opportunity to use it as a seasoning, if you will.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense, because it's just such a, you just want to stick your nose with quince and just hang out with it. It's
yeah.
beautiful. I love quince. So when I saw that, it really stood out to me. And where are you getting your quince? Is that locally or?
Not a lot of quince locally.
Yeah.
And frankly, the quince in California, I probably shouldn't say this, well, is not as good as the quince in Oregon yet. Well, we'll fix that. I was more impressed with the quince that I saw in Oregon. So we get it just outside of Portland.
Are there different varieties of quince?
Mm-hmm. There are. Interestingly, there's so little of it grown, nobody really knows what does best here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a wonderful resource up in Oregon. I can't recall whether it's in Corvallis
mm-hmm.
or in that neighborhood, called the U.S. Department of Agricultural, U.S. Department of Ag, what do they call it? Germplasm repository. So they have a collection of pears and apples and quince. And medlars, of all things. Anyways,
I'm not sure what a medlar is.
Medlar is kind of an antique fruit. It's a pomme fruit, and they used to eat them during Elizabethan times.
Hmm.
And instead of internet and television, they had medlars.
Hmm.
You have to blet your medlars, as it were. Anyways, a lot of the really interesting quinces don't have names. They've not been given names, and they're from the stands, from Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan mm-hmm. and Afghanistan. And,
sure.
And what's interesting about quinces is that they largely, the seeds largely stay true to the parents. So you can take a seed from a quince and actually propagate it and mm-hmm. get something that looks a lot like the parent. So anyways, there's a bunch of really interesting quinces that don't have names that I think could be quite interesting in California and elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And the apples, are you also getting those from Oregon then that you're working
with? The apples are from mostly Santa Cruz.
Oh, okay.
We got a lot of crabs though. Crab apples from Sacramento Delta. And again, crab mm-hmm. apples sort of make the cider, again, for astringency.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We don't, I mean, as you know, the tragic failing of California is we just don't have much of a cider culture. We don't historically, cider was never historically that important in California. So we don't grow cider apples by and large. Pretty much we don't. If you want to make cider, you have to be very creative and resourceful and
yeah.
use what you can find, and a lot of them are things that are kind of byproducts, like the crabs, which are pollinator apples,
yeah,
or pollinizer, I guess. Mm-hmm, say. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of dig deeper. But again, I'm hoping to remedy that one of these days.
Yeah. So when you're making the cider, you're not using any other apple except crab apples.
No, we used.
Sounds like you have a blend of different.
Oh, we probably used 6 or 7 different apples.
Okay.
Mostly the highest acid apples I could find.
Hmm. That's interesting. So the highest acid apples.
Well,
because I find a lot of ciders, you know, I've only really had one of your ciders, and that was a Perry. I had the sparkling Perry last uh-huh. night, which was delicious.
Mm-hmm. Really
delicious,
thanks.
Yeah. I like the finish quite a bit. But getting back to that question before I lose my track.
Uh-huh.
So you're using quite a bit of different apples, and you're dealing with wanting a high acid. That makes me really curious, because that's the style that you want to make, because I didn't really find your Perry. And that, of course, it's not an apple. That's not highly acidic. Some people really like that taste.
We don't do an apple cider. We do a product called Query, which is pear, apple, and quince.
Right.
And so, because pears are so low in acid, and the ones we grow in California, quince is low in acid. We had to find the acid somewhere. So the acid has to come from the apples.
Right, okay. That makes sense. And are the pears also coming from, like, Santa Cruz County?
No, pears are from Lake County, some Gartlets from Lake, and then some Seckles from, again, the Sacramento Delta
uh-huh.
area.
Uh-huh.
Seckles, Warrens, Pharrells, Hardy are the varieties we use.
Nice.
And then some Bartlett as well.
Right, right. Now, I'm kind of curious, because I know you, I've never met you before, but I know about you as a winemaker.
Right.
And so, and you have this amazing kind of ability to kind of fuse and blend and create these very unique wines. So why cider? Because you're really also involved in launching this project in San Juan Bautista.
Yeah. San Juan, I'm hoping we can incorporate cider into that as well. That would be great.
Yeah, I didn't hear any mention of that, so.
No, but we, you know.
Possibilities?
Keep it on the do low,
possible.
As it
yeah.
were.
Yeah.
I likely have undiagnosed attention deficit disorder, but I'm also just really curious about a lot of things.
Yeah, good.
I love cider, and ultimately, I'm trying to find products that we can make that are truly distinctive and original and make the world more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of wine out there, far too much wine. So, I don't know, I'm just interested in a lot of things,
mm-hmm,
cider
mm-hmm.
being one of them, vinegar being another one.
Okay.
I want to make a company called Vinegar on Purpose.
Yeah, right.
We make a fair bit of that, not on purpose. So.
I love that. Yeah, everybody's made it not on purpose, no doubt, leaving it in their refrigerator. Yeah. I see cider making really different than winemaking, though we use the same kind of principles in the two. How do you see that?
Well, since I only know about winemaking, I see them as quite similar, or at least I should say I'm bringing the only tools that I know to bear. And I suppose in one universe, one possible universe, you could consider single varietal ciders, which could be interesting, or you could consider ciders as a expression of place, which could be quite interesting. In my case, since we don't really have the varieties for single variety ciders, at least not for apple cider, and,
mm-hmm.
and pears are also tricky too. I don't think. I think that the pear cider that we do is pretty good, but it's, I think a blend of pears is probably more interesting. I guess so. The point is that I come to it as a blender, as a wine blender, and using the different components and what I understand about balance, try to fashion the most interesting blend I can, which will be have the right acid balance, the right mouth texture, aromatics, and have just a complex flavor. So that's the best I was able to come up with. Maybe there's better. But.
Well, I thought that was pretty good. Are the fruits, though, different? Do you approach them differently? I mean, you're having the quince and the pear and the apple. The wine has a certain terroir to it. And that's what you're getting at. You know, that's difficult to have that terroir if you're bringing in from all over the place with your...
Right, by definition.
Yeah.
You exclude terroir if you're blending from a disparate geographical area.
But there's a certain vitality that you're bringing in, too. Regardless of that, I'm sure you're pretty choosing where you're bringing in your fruits from very selectively and looking for a certain vitality in that land that it's growing in.
If possible. I mean, you know, that's aspirational. Honestly, I mean, this is even in our wine. We're lucky to get what people sell us. You know, you can't be... If I were as fussy as I wanted to be, we'd essentially be making no wine whatsoever. We'd be making like 4 bottles of wine per year. Huh. If you grow the grapes yourself or the fruit yourself, you can farm it biodynamically, organically. You can dry farm it. You can be as fastidious as you possibly can be. You can limit your soil types to, you know, particular blocks. You can be very fussy. And that I aspire to be very, very fussy. But for now, we're living in the Iron Age in a fairly limited, degraded market where, you know, beggars can't be choosers. And I'm a chooser, but at this point I'm mostly a beggar. I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, then again, you're still making really great ciders. And when you're making that perry or that query, what style are you typically going for? Because I noticed that when I had the sparkling perry, the finish was that kind of like farm style, but very, very subtle.
Uh-huh. Well,
is that what we could kind of expect out of Bonnie Dunes ciders, or are you just kind of experimenting? I mean, like,
still experimenting. You know, we've tried different techniques, bottle conditioned ciders, tank conditioned ciders. My hero is among my heroes. My cider hero, of course, is Eric Bordelais, who's a friend and genius. Interestingly, learned about cider making from Didier Dagenaud. Actually, he learned wine from Didier Dagenaud. He was a sommelier, but Didier was his mentor. And Didier taught him essentially as a winemaker. And his ciders have a soulfulness, a complexity, an elegance that I can only dream about, and that's of course what I aspire to. That is the style that's my paradigm. On the other hand, he's working in Normandy, you know, with 300-year-old pear trees that express pearoir, pearoir. That are extraordinary, and you know, these wonderful granitic soils, and you know, his ciders actually express soil characteristics. They express terroir, which is amazingly cool.
Yeah.
I can only dream of doing that someday. Maybe. Who knows?
Right. It takes a while to plant a tree. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we're kind of up against in that way. You have these different ciders, and I know that you do biodynamic. Am I assuming that, or... I saw the picture on Twitter of the horns. I said, oh, I know what that is.
Well, again, if you live in a world where your growers are compliant, I'm interested. We can make all biodynamic products, but if you, again, are begging your suppliers to sell you something, anything, you can't be this fussy. The stuff we grow ourselves, we can farm biodynamically, mm-hmm. but we're not yet at the point where we can totally be self-supporting. That's the aspiration.
So that's what I was curious about, because I kind of figured that you're sourcing from out of the area, and so I had this, you know, kind of little fantasy vision of, well, going up and picking the fruit on a fruit day.
Oh, yeah,
versus,
right. Oh, yeah.
You know, not even realistic.
Not even close. I mean,
okay.
It's
all
a
right.
wonderful fantasy.
All right, well.
I wish that were the case. We should pick our fruit on a fruit day, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah.
That'd be great.
A lot of changes have happened in the past couple of years because you sold the Bonnie Doon, the vineyards, right? No?
I sold a few of the brands. I sold our large brands. I sold Big House and Cardinal's Inn, Pacific Rim, and shrunk the production significantly. And of course, would love to continue to shrink it if I could find a way to do so.
And that allows you to kind of go off and do this project that you're really working towards. It might be nice to just let the listeners, even though this is a cider podcast, to just tell folks so they could know what you're doing in San Juan Bautista.
Oh, yeah, thanks. So I'm really interested in wines of place. That's what's most interesting to me. And the question is how to do it how to find those wines in a short lifetime. It's not totally obvious how feasible it is. So the thought I have is to farm in such a way that really intensifies the soil characteristics of the grapes and hence the wines, and I'm adopting a very unusual methodology. I mean, apart from dry farming, which itself, and biodynamic farming, which, the dry farming itself is a challenge, given the fact that it's fairly dry.
I'm not sure what you mean by dry farming. I know
dry farming is farming without supplemental irrigation.
Okay, all right.
So it's not irrigating apart from what comes mm-hmm. out of the sky.
Okay.
After the grapes are established, after the vines are established. So one of the methodologies we're looking at is breeding new grapes, hoping to incorporate some additional disease resistance into the plant, some resistance against powdery mildew and Pierce's disease, but also looking for grapes that are uniquely suited to the site, that have, you know, superior growing characteristics, flavor characteristics, but also looking at this fairly ambitious notion of blending a very heterogeneous population of grapes together. In other words, a population of an extremely large number of genetically distinctive individuals, in the hopes that that will create unusual degree of complexity, as well as actually suppress varietal characteristics such that soil characteristics might better emerge. So it's a little bit of a leap of faith and or logic, perhaps, but there is some theoretical basis for this. It's not entirely complete fantasy, mm-hmm. perhaps largely so, but not entirely. And so at the very least, though, it will leave, if it succeeds, some new germplasm that wasn't there before that may be interesting to other people down the road. Mm-hmm. One never knows. If you create 10,000 new grapes, it's very likely that among those 10,000 there might be some that are unique and special and make the world a more interesting place.
How long does it take from seed to vine to grow for that?
Depends on where you're growing it. If you're growing them in Davis, California, it's about 3 years. If you're growing them in Torino, Italy, it's about 10 years.
Because of the type of water or the
temperature,
the soil,
climate,
the temperature,
climate, especially
sun. Okay.
So my guess is that in San Juan Bautista, it'll take probably around 6 or 7 years for a vine to start bearing, to get enough growth.
Well, when I saw that and knew that I was talking to you, I thought about all the folks in the U.S. who are really kind of going towards planting the cider apple now, you know, and going that approach and trying to get that characteristic, because so many of those cider trees are missing from our landscape now.
Sure.
And it's kind of starting over in that same way. And there's excitement. There's going for that terroir that you're going for, and that really with the grape. And we also have that terroir with the apple. And it, the two projects really seem to be, you know, speak to a lot of people, because we're all trying to do that same thing, bring back for you a new type of grape variety.
Well, you know, it's,
or is that true?
It's maybe. I mean, I don't know that I'll have the time or the bandwidth to do this, but what I'm doing with grapes, one might consider doing with apples as well, and planting an orchard. Again, a highly heterogeneous orchard, just from seedlings, and which is what Johnny Appleseed did.
Yeah.
And again, with the assumption, and this is, again, it's a bit of an assumption, that any of the individual ones may not be particularly good to eat or particularly interesting. However, because you have so many different ones, is there some unique complexity that you might derive from this vast array of apples? Is there something interesting that comes from a seedling rather than from a cutting, from a rooting?
Right. And I think that always speaks to me about the vitality of the earth, you know, to that plant, and that's that the uniqueness. And I think a lot of cider makers should really be paying attention to what you're doing on this project, because that's exactly what a lot of orchardists want to do with apples, is bring back an apple tree at that level and really develop the fruit in a way that we're not seeing. You're seeing it, you're, like your friend in Normandy would have these 100-year-old trees, and we have that in the U.S., but not to that same degree. So there's a hankering to really get that, you know, the uniqueness. And there's so many different apples, just like with the grapes. So I think it's an interesting project that we should, if you're not into wine, it doesn't really matter. You should pay attention to what's going on and support the project, because it's really going to provide a lot of information.
Well, why even stop with apples? I mean, why not hybridize through other pomes? I don't know whether pears and apples are compatible, or pears and quinces, but potentially you could create other pomme fruits, or just a whole variety of different fruits.
Right. So, Randall, can you tell the listeners the name of the project, and if they wanted to get involved and support, because you're doing a campaign still.
Well, it's actually theoretically still live, amazingly.
Yeah.
It's through Indiegogo, and the project is called Popelouchum, Popelouchum, Popelouchum. And, you know, again, we're trying to raise some money to start the project and really just get it going. We're actually also initiated a petition for a charitable status, so we're seeking a nonprofit status with the IRS. So hopefully within a year or so, we might see that happen. Then we can be a little more ambitious in our fundraising efforts.
Okay, good.
Might make it easier for some people.
Yeah. Does that translate to? Am I correct in saying that translates to the project? That's why I saw it written, Popelouchum. Does that translate to anything? Or?
Oh, Popelouchum is a Mutsun word, which I've heard different translations, one being paradise, which is quite appropriate, and the other being the village, if you will.
Okay.
It was the name of the area where the indigenous folks lived hundreds of years ago.
Okay. Huh. Well, it's a really delicious name to say. So
it's a lovely name. Yes, it is indeed.
And that project is taking place to the east of where we are in Santa Cruz right now.
Southeast. We are about 50 minutes southeast.
50 minutes. Okay.
Santa Cruz. Yeah.
And you picked that area because?
Oh my gosh!
I don't know anything about it. He doesn't love the name San Juan Bautista. That's just like.
Well, San Juan Bautista is a funny little place. It's a tiny town. It doesn't have, I don't know, maybe 1,000 inhabitants, if that, maybe a couple thousand. I kind of ended up there sort of by accident. I had looked for land for quite a number of years, and then when I sold off these properties, I had a couple bucks to spend, and I was looking for areas that weren't developed because I wanted to plant from seed, and seeds, of course, seedlings are vulnerable to phylloxera, so you don't want vineyards, you want a virgin area, so you don't want vineyards, a lot of vineyards in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That was one, and of course, I wanted someplace that was ideally somewhat proximal to Santa Cruz, which is where I live and work. And I had dreamt about this place, and then I saw it, and I thought, my gosh, okay, if I dream about it and then I see it, this is perhaps quite favorable. And it turns out there's really unique geology in the area. There's a lot of different, really distinctive special soil types, beautiful limestone soils and granitic soils, volcanic soils, and there's a magical energetic quality to this place that is something. The place is really something.
Nice.
It's special. And it's interesting also, you know, when I first started in the wine business many, many years ago, it was not my first gig. Right after I started the business, I was leasing a few tanks from Josh Jensen at Calera Winery in Hollister, and I was living up in Bonnie Doon and driving from Bonnie Doon down to the Cienega Valley near Hollister, and drove right by San Juan Bautista, and did that every day. It was a fairly ambitious drive. And so this is, in a sense, is kind of a recapitulation of my very beginning in the wine business. It feels like the closing of a circle. And in many ways, I feel like I'm at the very beginning of my career rather than the very end of my career. Maybe it's both at the same time. But anyways, it feels like a beginning.
Nice. Well, I'll make sure to, in the show notes, I have links to that project and, of course, to everything you're doing here so folks could follow that and maybe get involved.
Great. Fantastic.
Yeah. I want to get back to the ciders that you're making and just talking about the yeast.
Uh-huh.
What are you doing with the yeast?
Indigenous
yeast. Okay. And is that also what you do with your wine?
Or? Yeah, we do, but we do it in a slightly...
And maybe you should say what you mean by indigenous yeast for...
Well, indigenous yeast are the yeast it's the yeast one imagines come in on the fruit itself. Mm-hmm. It's not always the case. If you're fermenting in a winery with a lot of other fermentations taking place nearby, it may well be yeast that's floating around, and certainly by mid-season, there's so much yeast in a winery that you're never really sure what is taking off. But at least in principle, what we try to do is observe the yeast. We do what's called a pied de cuve, so we'll take some juice and start a small fermentation and then look at the juice under the microscope and see what species of yeast we have. make sure that they're the right species, make sure they're healthy, and then make sure we've got the right number, the adequate population to inoculate, so we have a good, healthy population.
So, you're able to pull out the different yeast strains within that?
There's ways of selecting the ones you want. So we'll take the juice, we'll add sulfur dioxide to the juice, which kills off the weaker strains and selects for the Saccharomyces. So we'll theoretically get a Saccharomyces strain that came in from the vineyard. They're very different variations, but you know, if you've made wine in the same place over many, many years and returned your pumice to the vineyard, you'll develop an ecology. But we're not always privileged to do that. We buy grapes from other vineyards. Mm-hmm. We don't have the opportunity to take the pumice back out to that vineyard. So we begin de novo every time. Again, when you have your own vineyard and you start recycling your pumice, then you can establish a proper ecology.
Well, I think that's a great tip for cider makers because a lot, not all cider makers, there's folks who are bringing in the produce, I'm going to call it, from outside. But a lot of folks are pressing from their own orchards and you know, that's kind of the biodynamic way. You do the mash and then you bring it back out and it, you're starting to create your own terroir kind of yeast in a way. Mm-hmm. So if you could do that with grapes, you would definitely be able to do that with apples. So it'd be the same exact thing. So how do you separate that out, though? You have the wine and are you making the cider in the same building? Yeah, and is that's right here, right on this?
Well, we made some of it here. We made some of it remotely down in King City, Quarry. Again, not perfect, but that's sort of what we got. Strangely enough, the Quarry started. We were waiting for the quince. We pressed the pears and apples, everything kind of comes in on its own schedule, and we couldn't hold them in cold storage any longer. Mm-hmm. They were getting ripe and ready to go, so we had to press them. We pressed it, and we're holding it very, very cold, as cold as we could. Mm-hmm. It started spontaneously fermenting at 35 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
Luckily, it was fermenting very slowly, but we got the quince in the nick of time, and sort of all worked out. But,
How exciting, though. I mean, I think that's just to hear that, what you're doing. And when you are you using that same kind of like conical from, you know, what is your equipment like that you're using too?
Again, I wish I could give you this beautiful romantic picture of this.
It's okay.
This earth egg, you know, this cosmic egg made out, you know. Someday, maybe, I hope. Just a plain old stainless steel tank. Nothing's fancy. Just a plain old stainless steel tank.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Again, in a perfect world, it would be, you know, fashioned from the earth, from, you know, whence the fruit derived, but, you know. Ain't gonna happen anytime soon, I'm afraid.
You know, there's some cider makers in Virginia. It's called Castle Hill, and they imported at Kevry's.
Oh, Kevry's are beautiful,
and, in the ground, and they're making cider in there. The cool. Only place I know about
Kevry's in Czech. I know from Turkey or from.
I can from let Turkey. You know exactly, yeah. But they brought them over, and they have them in Virginia. And they're
Kevry's
making cider.
Who knew?
I know. I know. I got to speak to the cider makers there. It's pretty interesting. Now, do you have any adjuncts that go into your ciders, or is it just the pressed juice?
Pretty well. We add malic acid for the ones that are deficient.
Any back sweetening at the back end, or nothing like that?
No. we don't do that.
I didn't want to assume, so I just wanted to kind of ask, because I you know, that the pair that I had last night, the pairing was...
Winter Nellis.
Yeah, the Winter Nellis. Really very subtle aroma, as carbonation, the sparkling.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the finish was that kind of a dry but sweet. It was a really nice balance. And so I wanted to make sure, because I'm sure a lot of folks don't consider it real cider, you know, if you're adding, and some folks do. So... since I'm right at the source, I might as well just ask the source where you're going with that. Because folks are really curious about that, including myself. You're not able to make it throughout the year. So it's just one vintage.
Correct.
Just as one would do with a grape.
Correct, yes.
Yes, okay. Yeah, and I think that's really unique to your label, that some people are doing it all, or cider makers are doing it year-round, and you're doing
it. Well, that's cool, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different beast.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? You know, we've planted some antique pears and apples and quince at our place in San Juan, and we still have to plant more. I'm hoping to plant a bunch more.
When you say plant, how many are you talking about that you
plant? Well, we have maybe just a couple hundred trees.
Okay.
But
that's pretty good. Some people just have an acre of orchard, and then, you know.
Yeah. It's better than a poke in the eye. So, I forget what I was going with that idea. But, I don't know yet what style we're going to end up with. You know, we have to really see what the fruit will give us.
Mm-hmm.
Trees are still really young.
So let's just talk about, for the listeners to know, would you say like three styles that you... are on the market that people could get right now?
Well, at the moment, I think there's just the Winter Nellis and the Quarry. Although there may be two vintages of Quarry. There's there's one that's a bottle condition, one that's a tank condition.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think the bottle fermented is largely gone. There might be a tiny bit left. And that one's bone dry, with higher level of effervescence, and then the other one is not quite as dry, but quincier.
Mm-hmm. And I've been hearing. I'm sorry. I've been hearing quite a bit about the 2015 crop of, you know, apples and fruit.
Yeah.
What's been your experience on that? What do you think that we'll be seeing coming from what you made?
Well, we didn't make any cider in 15 because we couldn't get the fruit.
Wow.
Alas. But it was a very dry, as you know, very dry year, short year. Everything was, grapes were short.
Hmm.
This was a really difficult year. It was a really difficult year. A lot of orchards, I don't know about fruit, apple orchards and pear orchards, but many orchards certainly had water restrictions and... Their yields were really down
in California.
In California, yeah.
But you are sourcing some from the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think they had a pretty. They did really well.
They did fine.
Yeah. So will we see anything for 2015? Are you going to put that on your calendar? Or
not for cider, but we make wine in 2015.
Okay.
But hopefully we'll do it again in 16.
Okay. Great. Well, I'll be keeping an eye out for that. I was really happy that my sister-in-law is a member of your club and she had the Perry. It was really exciting for me to try that. Well, I really appreciate
your time. My pleasure.
It's really great to speak with you.
Thank you again, Randall Graham. What a privilege it was for me to be able to have the opportunity to speak with you, with him, and with all of you on this Cider Chat. I think there was a lot of tips that if you listen closely, you're going to be able to derive from this particular chat. And it's his skill as a winemaker over the years and his ability to really look at the blend, looking at how you made the Quarry, really high acidic apples, and looking for that right acid balance, a mouth texture, the aromics, and complex flavor. You have to know how to kind of pull it all together and take what you have and move it forward. And we spoke a little bit about biodynamic. When I mentioned the horns, that's what I was talking about there. And there was a link again into the show notes about biodynamic farming. And that kind of piqued my interest when I, you know, I was doing a little bit of research ahead of time on Bonnie Doone Vineyard, and I knew that he had an interest in biodynamic farming. So maybe some of my fantasies of them going out and planting the horns in the ground, which is a biodynamic technique, and it's kind of like homeopathy with the soil. There's a fruit day, a flower day, a root day, and a seed day, and all that is incorporated, and it's based off anthroposophical teachings of Rudolf Steiner. Really interesting stuff. And it's really a step beyond organic farming, which has in some ways been unfortunately co-opted by the powers that be. So he brought that information for me forward in a way that I thought that was really interesting. I hope it was interesting for you. Again, I'm going to recommend that you go to ciderchat.com, episode 12. It's Randall Graham, Bonnie Doone Vineyard, California. And you could find out what we're talking about there if you did miss it during the actual chat. Alrighty then. Well, thank you so much for coming along on this chat. And next week, we have an amazing, amazing little story that is going to be on mobile juicing. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, how about if you share this chat? Let folks know that there is a place called Ciderville where we are chatting with cider makers and cider enthusiasts just like you. In the meantime, I'm going to roll out of here. This is Real Wind Color, signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you soon in Ciderville.